Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome to Quality of Life for Tuesday, March 15th, 2011. While California lawmakers negotiate a solution to the state's budget crisis, the future of a popular, powerful, and little-known arm of local government, redevelopment agencies, happens to hang in the balance. Later on our program, we'll talk about the pros and cons of redevelopment and what Governor Brown's plan to eliminate the state's 400 such agencies would mean for the Valley. That's coming up in a few minutes on Quality of Life. But first, we look at another issue that impacts the lives of all Valley residents, the environment, and its impact on our health. Last month, Forbes magazine ranked the nation's 10 most toxic cities, and Bakersfield and Fresno were ranked number 2 and 3, right behind the nation's leader in that dubious category, Philadelphia. The publication evaluated cities in five categories: air quality, water quality, the number of Superfund sites in each area, the EPA's air quality index performance in those cities, and the city's toxic release inventory. Bakersfield was singled out for its 43 unhealthy air days and 2.2 million pounds of toxic releases, and Fresno for its 26 unhealthy air days, 300,000 pounds of toxic releases, and nitrate polluted water. So we're talking about our air and water quality today on Quality of Life, and we'd like to know what you think. Is the Valley one of the most toxic places to live? You can call us with your comments on our program today. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll free 800-224-8989. Later on, we'll be joined by a guest from the South Valley to talk about some water quality issues. But right now, we're talking about air quality, and we have a guest in our studio right now with us, Syed Sadreddin, the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. Syed, welcome to our program.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here.
What was your reaction when you read the article in Forbes?
Well,
things are often in these publications. Men's Health one time last year rated Fresno as, I believe, the drunkest city in America. Mm-hmm. The Daily Beast rated Fresno as number 55 out of 55 cities in terms of intelligence. They often are articles that are designed to get attention. What was your reaction to this?
Well, first of all, I have to give it to them as a marketing technique. I've been traveling up and down the state, and it looks like at every meeting that I go to, they are talking about some sort of a list that Forbes magazine put together, and people get excited about it. They click on the link, and they go to the newspaper or the magazine and look at it. So it is very effective in that respect. But unfortunately, if you really want to use it as a tool or as a informational point to make decisions, it falls short in that regard in terms of giving you meaningful and good information to essentially use for making life decisions based on.
But doesn't it also raise awareness of this issue? Certainly in the last 10 years, awareness of air quality has increased significantly in the Valley. Does this perhaps give a larger national spotlight to the issues the Valley faces?
It does, and we need to use it in that way to perhaps get the story out in terms of what is really going on in the Valley. First of all, air quality is an important issue for the public. Polls always show that it's one of the top issues of concern to the Valley residents. But we also need to look at the information in more in depth to find out what is really going on in the Valley. The term toxic and healthy and you know, catchy terms like that that could instill fear in people are perhaps not the best choices when you want to get meaningful and objective information to the public.
One of the interesting things about the air quality issue is it's not one issue. There's a number of different types of pollutants that we're looking at that in some cases the Valley has made great progress in improving the air, in other cases not as much. Let's talk about a few of those things right now. We're in March, the annual fall-winter burn season, people lighting their fireplaces at homes. That's pretty much come to a close at this point. Do you have any data that you can share with our listeners in terms of the Valley's performance in that season this past year?
Right. First of all, I want to thank all the Valley residents for really taking this check before you burn program seriously and really complying with our demands for on certain days refraining from burning. We are coming off of our second cleanest winter on record. This winter, last winter, and the one before that were the cleanest on record. Now, we still have a lot of work before us to really get to clean air. But if you look at our history, this last winter we had only two unhealthy days in Fresno and no unhealthy days anywhere else in San Joaquin Valley, all the way from San Joaquin up north to Bakersfield. The people really responded, and we really made great improvements in our air quality.
How much do you attribute that to the programs? How much can you attribute that to things like weather? We had a very wet December this year, January not so much. Do those things just balance out in the end, or is it a combination of factors?
That's a good question. And every year at the end of the season, we do a very in-depth report and analysis of what went on in the last season, looking at what other factors could have contributed to air quality. This year, economy also was a factor, economy being down, and weather is always a factor. But once we exclude the impact from these various factors, there's clear evidence that the program to reduce wood burning was really the key reason for the improvements in air quality. After all, 30% of the total pollution during the winter months comes from wood burning.
We're talking with Syed Sadreddin from the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District on our program today, and we'd like to know your thoughts on the efforts to clean the valley's air. Is enough being done? You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. And have you noticed the personal improvement in air quality? I hear that anecdotally from people off and on, especially in the last few years, that some people say, well, you know, it's not as bad as it was in 2000 or in the late 90s. Do you hear that from people, and is that accurate?
Yeah, we definitely do. And you know, we have a number of monitors that monitor air quality up and down the valley 24 hours a day. We have a very expensive and scientific process in place to measure air quality. But the one that really people pay attention to is how often can I see the mountains on both sides of my city or where I live. And we get those calls and those remarks more often now that I can see the mountains and air quality is getting better. And that is reflective of what we see in our monitors and the very expensive data gathering system that we have in place.
Now, I want to ask you about a couple of things that have been in the news in the past few months, going back to the last quarter of 2010. And specifically, last October, there was an effort. The Valley made national news, and your district made national news, in its effort to implement a new fee on Valley motorists to help clean up the air. This $12 fee on each vehicle license that happens to be registered here in the Valley, it's designed to help clean up the fleet of mobile sources. And we're talking about school buses and diesel trucks and things like that. And as I understand it, this is because the Valley missed a cleanup deadline for ozone, the one-hour ozone standard under the EPA's Clean Air Act. What is the latest on that effort? Has it been approved by the EPA at this point?
We're still going through that process, and things like that take some time before the EPA's bureaucracy completes the process before them. But just to give it a little bit of a background as to what was all behind all of those decisions and the discussion and the debate that we engaged last year. If for this one-hour standard, if you go back about 10 years, we used to have 60 violations of that standard every year. For the last 2-3 years, we're down to a handful of violations, and these violations in the more recent times have come just at the beginning of the school season when the traffic starts, and also we get some hot days in late summer. And basically, we've reached a point where we've implemented a number of regulations on Valley businesses. We have some of the toughest regulations on businesses. And today, our air quality problem, over 80% of it is really attributable to motor vehicles. And this penalty, when it kicked in, we basically had one option: to either collect the penalty from the businesses, go to the motor vehicles and perhaps divide the penalty equitably between the stationary sources or mobile sources, or have EPA collect that penalty and take the money out of the valley and basically not seeing it in terms of any usable form for San Joaquin Valley. And based on that, we implemented this $12 DMV fee where we take these funds and reinvest it all of it, every penny of it, back in the community in the form of clean air projects, replacing school buses, lawnmowers, and a whole host of other good projects that would reduce air pollution.
That particular effort, that particular idea to have this additional fee on vehicle licenses in the Valley proved to be somewhat controversial from a number of sides. You had business groups who didn't want that business fee implemented on their businesses and their concerns. You had motorists who were concerned about paying an additional $12. And then you also had air quality activists who said this is not enough and actually advocated for businesses paying the fee, saying that in some cases businesses are responsible for that extra ozone pollution. How do you – it seems like a person in your situation or your district is in the midst of a number of different – it caught in the middle of a number of different angles of different interests. How do you go about trying to craft public policy when you have such competing interests and trying to create a solution that works for the Valley?
That's a great question. And for us, for those of us who care about air quality in San Joaquin Valley, we've reached a point where we need to welcome or at least tolerate to look in the mirror in terms of where the air quality problem, the bulk of it comes from at this point. 80% of our air pollution comes from mobile sources, trucks, automobiles, and some of these off-road devices. We're not going to be able to get to clean air, if you really care about clean air, on the back of businesses alone, because we've reduced air pollution from many businesses by over 90%. We have some of the toughest regulations on businesses anywhere in the nation. And if we want to get meaningful reductions in air pollution, we really need to get the public involved in terms of their driving habits, how we design our communities, sprawl, minimizing that, and also taking the responsibility that $12 per vehicle, what we can do with that is quite significant, and it can be done in a way that will not hurt Valley's economy. If that $30 million a year penalty, in effect, the federal penalty, was imposed entirely on Valley businesses, the impact of that would have been a lot greater on each of us, on our neighbors that would have lost jobs, because those businesses in this economy, they were not going to be able to bear that penalty.
Some of the critics, though, said that the Clean Air Act actually requires that penalty to come from businesses. Is that correct, or what's your interpretation
of that? That is not correct. EPA came up with a guidance in January of this year that basically said in areas where the impact can be shown to be coming from mobile sources, you could actually divide the responsibility equitably to mobile sources and stationary sources, and we're using that guidance. Now, I have to say that some of the environmental groups are challenging that guidance that came from EPA at the national level, and if that guidance or that policy does not withstand the legal scrutiny, then we have to rethink our approach.
Let's go ahead and go to the phones now. We have Michael from the South Valley. Michael, you're on Quality of Life.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I can tell you that I used to work for an air pollution control district other than this one, and I worked in enforcement. There are a lot of things that you can do by way of law and regulation, but the truth is, until you get the mentality of the people that live here changed, you will not have meaningful air pollution control. Because I still see burn barrels everywhere I go. I still see pickup trucks, mostly diesels, that people strip all the emissions controls off of and put a chip that pollutes 90 times more than a gasoline-powered truck. I still see people burning on non-burn days, and even with the attitude of, hey, I'm going to burn if I want to, and if they come, I'll sign the ticket. So until we have actual meaningful enforcement, we're not going to make progress.
Well, thank you very much for that call, Michael, and I'll direct that question to Syed. What about the mentality issue? Are we talking about a cultural change here as in addition to simply implementing rules and other sorts of things, and are we seeing any indicators of that type of change?
Yeah, I think the caller really reflects a sentiment that is really the core problem in San Joaquin Valley, in that it's easy always for us as individuals to point the finger at somebody else, at businesses or at the district, say the district's not doing something or the businesses are not doing something. And these sort of sentiments come up only when we ask people, don't use your fireplace, don't drive as much. Then instead of looking in the mirror and saying, what is it that I can do to improve air quality, they come up with anecdotal stories such as this that I saw somebody burn, and well, that means let's not do many of these meaningful measures that we have to put in place. And that is very difficult. You know, I've been doing this for about 30 years. We've done many rules that have cost businesses, in our estimate, $40 billion with a strong enforcement. And as difficult politically as those endeavors have been in terms of bringing about some of these tough regulations, it's never been as difficult as when we've tried to tell the general public, do your part. We get run over, our building, you know, gets run over by people that just don't want to do their part, and we get hate mail and things like that. So that is the cultural change that we need the public to really accept, that we need to look in the mirror. We, the people, are the biggest source of air pollution in San Joaquin Valley today.
Let's go back to the phones now and talk to Matthew in Bakersfield. Matthew, you're on Quality of Life.
Hi, guys. I want to ask about barbecues, public barbecues, businesses and funeral homes. But first, Joe, I want to say gently that I appreciate your efforts, but I really miss Terry Phillips. He was extremely experienced and intelligent and polite.
Well, thank you very much.
Polished.
Back to your question.
Barbecues. I've passed a road where a business lit their barbecue, and white-blue smoke was about 80% of the parking lot. It was a big parking lot, and I understand they have an exemption. And then my wife works at a business next to a funeral home, and fire trucks pulled up, and people were saying the building's on fire, and it turns out that a crematory service went out of control, and thick black smoke belched for about 15 minutes. And I want to know why those two have exemptions.
Thank you very much for that call.
Well, the crematories don't have an exemption. In fact, we do permit them, and they are subject to strict regulations in terms of the control devices that they need to have on the chimney on the crematory. It has to reduce air pollution by over 99%, or else it will not be permitted. Now, if they had a breakdown and this was an incident that does not happen normally, I'm sure we were involved and dealt with that. As far as barbecues go, we have one of the toughest regulations on commercial char broilers in San Joaquin Valley. We've had that in place for a number of years, and a couple of years ago we added some additional requirements. The only broilers that are exempt at this point are the Ender Fire broilers that are basically an open pit, because the technology has not evolved yet where we do have a workable and cost-effective means to control them. But we are spending about $500,000 at the district to research available technologies for that, and we're hoping to be able to have a workable technology in a year or so.
Last December, the California Air Resources Board made a change in course in terms of the implementation of new restrictions on requirements on diesel trucks and other mobile sources and from diesel engines that are contributing to a good bit of the pollution here in the valley. Can you explain a little more about that, and what does that mean for the valley and operators who had already purchased the new equipment that they thought they were going to be required to have this year?
Right. As I said earlier, mobile sources, cars and trucks, are the biggest source of air pollution in San Joaquin Valley, over 80%. And of that 80%, 55% of it comes from trucks that pass up and down through the valley, both local traffic as well as the pass-through truck traffic. And there is no way this area can meet any of these standards if we don't make a significant reduction in truck emissions. Now, last December, ARB relaxed these regulations. They gave a few additional years to truckers to come into compliance. And under ARB's assessment, they felt that because of the economic downturn, the pollution had already been reduced significantly by trucks, and the relaxations that they allowed last December, in their assessment, did not really impact the total emission reductions that we need, because we had reductions due to economic downturn. Now, we did express some concerns at the hearing to ARB that if any of their estimates, which included some projections in terms of economic recovery timing and the magnitude of it in the coming years, and also what the state of economy was right now, and what our concern was, that they left us no margin, that if they were off by any amount, a ton a day, that would put our plans in jeopardy, that would not only have detrimental impact on air quality, but it will also pose legal jeopardy and penalty to Valley businesses in terms of not meeting federal mandates. So those relaxations, if ARB's estimates are accurate, they will be okay, but they leave us no margin for error, and we need to stay on top of it in terms of checking the numbers and making sure the economic recovery does not is in line with what ARB's projections were in terms of the magnitude of relaxations that they provided in those regulations.
In terms of health impacts and air quality here in the Valley, this is a major issue that impacts public health, and that means literally everyone in our listening area here in Central California. We all share the same air that we breathe. We're looking, I've seen some interesting statistics here from your website, 460 premature deaths each year caused by air quality, air pollution, 325 new cases of chronic bronchitis, 3,230 new cases of acute bronchitis in children. These are staggering numbers. Have those numbers shown improvement over the years? Is there a positive trend there? Is there any good news in those numbers somewhere?
Well, there has definitely been a positive improvement in air quality, and those numbers have come down. But there is no way that we can or I can come here with mission accomplished sign behind me and say our work is done. We still have a long ways to go, and we need to reduce emissions quite a bit. Just imagine if we had a hurricane here that resulted in 460 people dying. Just imagine the public reaction and the magnitude of help that we would receive from the federal government and from various sources. And fortunately, when it comes to air quality and those statistics, they're not comprehensible, or people don't see it in real terms as you would if there was a catastrophe here and some sort of a earthquake that unfortunately, like we have in Japan, and 400 people died. But so this is serious. There has been significant improvement, but we have a long ways to go.
Our guest today on our program has been Syed Sadreddin. He is the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. Syed, thank you so much for joining us today on Quality of Life.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment and talk about water quality here in the Valley and learn more about what's happening in Tulare County and a small community that has been singled out by the United Nations for its water system, and not in a good way. That's coming up next on Quality of Life on FM 89. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. We're continuing our talk about the environment today, and we have a guest on the phone right now from Visalia to tell us a little more about water quality in the Valley. Maria Herrera, the Community Outreach Coordinator from the Community Water Center, joins us. Maria, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you for having us.
The issue of water quality was one that was raised in that recent Forbes magazine article ranking Fresno and Bakersfield as the number three and two most toxic cities in the nation, respectively. And while those cities were named, we're really looking at problems that affect all of the Valley. And there's some particular problems affecting small communities in Tulare County when it comes to water quality. Tell us a little more about some of the problems that communities like Seville are facing.
Well, currently, right now, many residents throughout the Valley lack safe drinking water in their homes. In Tulare County alone, over 20% of the small public water systems are unable to provide safe drinking water to its residents, and this problem is almost entirely due to nitrate contamination. But it's not only the small public water systems. We also have a number of private well owners in the Valley also facing similar challenges when it comes to drinking water.
We're talking about nitrates here. What does that mean? What is this type of pollution, and where is it coming from?
So nitrates an acute contaminant. It normally comes from fertilizer, irrigated ag, pesticides, and animal waste. And as you can see in the Valley, we have intensive agricultural and dairies. It's also known to come from septic tanks, but by far the two largest sources is irrigated ag, fertilizer and pesticide, and animal waste. Nitrates, it's very dangerous to the health. It's dangerous primarily to pregnant women and children 6 months of age, but it's also known to cause cancer in adults. for children, it's very dangerous because it can cause the blue baby syndrome. That's literally when the blood is unable to absorb the oxygen, the baby can turn blue. And for pregnant women, it has known to cause miscarriages, spontaneous abortion. So it's a very serious contaminant.
As I understand it, your organization helped draw some attention to this issue at a very high level with the United Nations. There's a United Nations lawyer who's investigating unsafe drinking water across the globe. And Seville, this small community in Tulare County of just 350 residents, has drawn attention from this particular organization.
Yes. I think the reason why we chose Seville is because we really feel that Seville highlights the challenges that many of the communities face throughout the valley. I mean, the issue is not unique to Seville, but Seville has all of the challenges, beginning from lack of safe drinking water because of nitrates, really old infrastructure. Seville has piping that's over 100 years old, that's above ground and leaks throughout the community. They also have a local school, Stone Corral, which is currently having to spend around $500 to $600 from their educational fund to provide safe drinking water to its students. And for that reason, we decided to have the expert come to Seville to be able to see firsthand the different challenges that our communities are facing, but with the clear understanding that the issue is not unique to Seville. Seville is just one of many.
How much of this issue is an issue of pollution, and how much of it is an issue of poverty? We have large-scale agriculture throughout the valley. Many larger cities have the types of resources that allow them to provide clean water and filtration systems and other things to clean the water. We're talking about a very impoverished community as well here in some of these small communities in the valley. How much of it is also the valley's issue with poverty in addition to pollution?
Well, I think, you know, for one, I think pollution is a big issue because over 90% of our communities rely on groundwater as their source of drinking water. However, as I mentioned earlier, we continue to allow some of the most intensive ag to apply fertilizers, pesticide, and animal waste products without any protections for our aquifers below. So this is a matter of pollution. I think the problem has been created by pollution, and the people who are now paying for that pollution are the low-income families of California. I think the other issue is that you're right, poverty does have a big issue and a big role in this problem, in terms of that it's the poor people who are affected, the people who don't have good representation and aren't really at the priority of many throughout California. One clear example is the way that California funds its water projects. Most of the time, our communities aren't able to take advantage of funding such as stimulus funding, and it takes years, I'm talking over a decade, for our communities to be able to get funding to fix their water issues. And as a result, families, you know, the most impoverished families of this state are having to pay twice for water, once for a water bill for water they can't drink, and then again when they're having to drive to neighboring communities to purchase alternative sources. And they do this to keep their families safe, because they know that the health risk is there, and they will do whatever they can to protect the health of their loved ones.
If people want to learn more about this problem, what can they do?
Well, they can visit our website at www.communitywatercenter.org, or they can call our center 559-733-0219. But most importantly, I mean, they can start with their own water quality, figuring out whether they pay a water bill. They can call their water provider and ask for the recent testing and figure out if their water is safe. And for those who are on private wells, they should look at testing their water and figuring out whether their water is safe.
Well, Maria, I really want to thank you for joining us today. I apologize for the short segment. We are going to have to talk about this again in a larger context. This is a very interesting issue and one that I hope to revisit with you again in the future. Our guest today has been Maria Herrera, the Community Outreach Coordinator for the Community Water Center in Visalia. Maria, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned because we'll be back in just a moment to talk about Governor Brown's effort to balance the state budget, in part through the elimination of the state's redevelopment agencies. We'll examine the pros and cons of this multi-million dollar program and get your thoughts coming up next on Quality of Life.
Friends, this week on Valley Writers Read, Wednesday at 7, it's all about an event that occurred 41 years ago at Fresno State when the administration forcibly closed the university's English department. What happened made the news all over the country. And this week, the former chairman of that English department, Dr. Gene Zumwalt, recalls what took place when he reads his story, Beyond the Roses. It all happened in 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War, when our country experienced many demonstrations, counter-demonstrations, sit-ins, teach-ins, protests, even some riots. But what occurred at Fresno State on that Friday in 1970 is unprecedented. Join us this Wednesday at 7 on Valley Writers Read as Dr. Zumwalt recalls the event and its effects on all of us.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. One of the biggest battles in Governor Brown's effort to close the state's $25 billion budget gap involves the elimination of local redevelopment agencies. At stake is $1.7 billion in property tax revenue currently controlled by over 400 such agencies in the state, including Bakersfield, Fresno, and Merced. Over 60 years ago, California lawmakers authorized the formation of redevelopment agencies to reduce inner-city blight and later to fund affordable housing. Redevelopment agencies, often known as RDAs, borrow against the future increases in property tax revenues, known as tax increment, to fund their activities, including land acquisition, infrastructure, and development subsidies. Statewide, 12% of property taxes are diverted to redevelopment. Critics say redevelopment agencies siphon off property tax dollars that would otherwise be used for schools and local government, and spend money on dubious projects. Supporters, including most of the state's mayors, claim that redevelopment is an essential tool in revitalizing urban areas, creating jobs, low-income housing, and improving communities. If Governor Brown's budget is approved by the legislature, the agencies would be dissolved by July 1st. Supporters say they'll challenge that move in court as a violation of Proposition 22, passed by voters last November, which forbids the state from raiding local funds to balance the state budget. Today, we'll talk about the pros and cons of redevelopment and other incentives like enterprise zones. We'd like to hear what you think. Are redevelopment agencies essential services that improve our communities in the Valley, or are they examples of government waste and abuse that need to go away? Call us with your thoughts right now. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. And we're now joined in our studio by Fresno's Redevelopment Agency Board Chair and council member from District 4, Larry Westrum. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us a little more about your reaction to the governor's plan, which came out early this year, I guess, talk about it, came out late last year, this plan to eliminate redevelopment. The stealing or borrowing money or taking money from redevelopment is nothing new. The governor in the past, Governor Schwarzenegger and the legislature, took $2 billion in the past few years to help balance the state budget. But this is something different.
Right. You know, you're absolutely. And in the last couple of years, I've analogized it. It may be a crude analogy, but I think it's an accurate one. In the last couple of years, we have had tax increments stolen from the redevelopment agencies by the legislature and the governor. And then this year, in an effort to get around Proposition 22, they can't hold a gun and steal the money from us. So they've got to shoot us and kill us to get around it. So it's the difference between a armed robbery and a homicide this year. And that's what really the whole elimination issue is. And that's what the governor is proposing right now. I've heard that they didn't like my analogy. They thought it was a bad analogy and asked me to apologize to the taxpayers for that analogy. And I'm more than happy to apologize for a rough analogy just as soon as the governor decides to apologize to the taxpayers of the state of California for actually going against and holding in great contempt the will of the people of the state of California that passed Proposition 22 less than 120 days ago, saying to keep your hands off redevelopment agency dollars because that's what we want it to go for. And the legislature looks like, with the governor's lead on it, are going to just disregard the voters' will through Prop 22.
We're also joined on the phone by Daniel Ainslie. He is the development manager for the City of Merced, involved with the City of Merced's redevelopment agency. Daniel, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We're talking about the impact to local cities with the elimination, the proposed elimination of redevelopment agencies. What would that mean for Merced?
Well, what it means for Merced, you hear often a draconian cut. I mean, this exceeds that even. This is all money that originates from the local government, from the local property taxes, that will now be siphoned off to Sacramento. What it's going to mean in Merced, right now, every single construction project that's occurring in Merced is funded through redevelopment. In addition, next year, there's over 100 housing units that are going to be produced. Unfortunately, that's about all the housing that's going to be constructed in Merced. If redevelopment goes away, all of those things would stop. So already an anemic economy will become even worse. There's over 250 people right now that are working in construction on redevelopment projects. Once redevelopment goes away, those jobs are gone. In addition, redevelopment has brought in numerous private sector jobs in the community. Over 6% of all the private sector jobs in Merced are in redevelopment projects. I mean, right now it's obvious that we need that number to grow, but once you take away the engine of that growth, that number will never grow. And this is short-sighted at best of the governor to even think about trying to kill the economic engine of the growth of the valley.
Now, there have been a number of critics of redevelopment, one of them being State Controller John Chang. He released a report earlier this month criticizing redevelopment agencies, saying they don't have a consistent methodology to capture accurate and reliable data about job creation, and singled out a number of different agencies for lax following the rules in particular areas, spending money that was supposed to be spent on housing, on other things. Fresno's redevelopment agency was one of those audited in that report. And turning back to you, Councilmember Westerlund, what was your reaction to the report from the state controller?
Well, I from the City of Fresno perspective and our redevelopment agency, it turned out it was primarily very positive. We have operated very prudently, very fiscally conservative, and I think that reflected that in the report that the state controller did. And there were certainly some areas and some project areas around the state that had some issues and some concerns. You know, certainly one of the things that they did point out is how we did or didn't capture job creation, and that's certainly something that the legislature could have in the last 65 years prescribed how we should have captured and measured job creation dollars. For the Fresno, we actually try to peg it to a federal standard to do that, and I think it's a better way to do things than some agencies that didn't track it even at all. So altogether, I think it pointed out something of a mixed bag throughout the state, but one of the things that at least I've always talked about and as I've talked with state legislators about is we're certainly willing to look at reform measures that would make it a stronger, better organization. There are some areas that really probably don't and shouldn't qualify, and maybe they did years ago when they got in place to be a redevelopment project area. One that comes to mind is Coronado, the island there where North Island Naval Air Station is, and not quite sure how that area became a redevelopment project area, but certainly a place like Fresno or Corcoran or Parlier or Merced, those are areas that absolutely positively should be, and that's why they are redevelopment project areas.
Now, one of the issues involving redevelopment and the effort to eliminate these agencies is the governor announced this some time ago, and that gave the cue to local agencies that their money may be going away. A number of cities have done some interesting things. San Diego, I believe, in one day allocated $4 billion in redevelopment money going out to 2048 or something like that. What has the city done? I understand in Fresno, in this case, there were 11 items approved on March 3rd, 13 items on March 8th, a little higher than normal. I'll direct it to you, Larry, and then we'll also get to Merced and get our guest, Daniel, from the city of Merced's reaction.
Certainly, yes. You know, one of the things that we have tried to do is to move expeditiously through the process, things that were in the pipeline, projects that were in the pipeline. And that's what we've seen. We've put a push to get as many of those projects to the council, acting as the redevelopment agency board, for approval. So I think altogether we've probably done 28 projects that have all been in the pipeline one way or another here in the last month or so. One of the things that we have seen around the state, and you alluded to or directly referenced San Diego, is, and I made a motion last Tuesday when we had a special meeting to do this, is to set up a cooperation agreement between the city of Fresno and the redevelopment agency, which are two separate legal entities. And the idea being is that you can protect a certain amount of your tax increment by putting a contract between the redevelopment agency and the city. I can tell you that I made the motion. I didn't get a second. And it didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're going to try to bring that back or not. But what you saw in San Diego for $4.1 billion is them to try to tie up their tax increment so that the state couldn't take it.
And Daniel, what has Merced done?
Yeah, Merced actually has done something fairly similar to what San Diego did. We transferred all of our redevelopment property as well as our funds that we had available over to the City of Merced Finance Authority. That's a separate legal entity from both the city and the redevelopment agency. We did that because several of the properties that the redevelopment agency owns are brownfields or contaminated sites that we really can't have the city hold the financial burden of those. But it's still important that the reinvestment in those properties continue. So we did transfer those over to a separate entity. We also did put in place a cooperative agreement between that financing authority and the redevelopment agency. That way we can protect a lot of the future tax increment of the agency. Unfortunately, that only protects about a third of the total revenue in future years, but we had to do all that we could do. So we've protected the current assets as well as about a third of the future revenue for the agency.
Let's go ahead and go to the phones now. We have Fresno City Councilmember Oliver Baines from District 3. Councilmember Baines, welcome to Quality of Life today.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Tell us your thoughts about redevelopment. A lot of the projects, a lot of the investment in downtown Fresno, West Fresno, takes place in your district in terms of redevelopment. What would it mean for your constituents?
You know, it would be devastating for me and my constituents. And actually, I just want to let you know that our board here, Councilmember Westerland, does a great job of really explaining the importance of RDAs and where the direction that we have tried to go as a city. What I'd like to take a moment to just talk about is something I think is a little overlooked in this conversation, and that's really the governor's philosophy that he's going to take the redevelopment agency dollars and reinvest them into schools and public safety. And I take issue with that because I think what isn't talked about is the problem that we actually do have in education in our state. And I would submit that after talking to educators myself, and we're talking teachers, so I want to make sure that the distinction that we have between, you know, the teachers union and the administration of in education is different from what teachers actually see on the ground and what teachers actually see in the classroom. But when you talk to teachers will tell you that the struggle that students have starts at home. And when you're talking about the achievement gap that we have in our city and in our state, when you talk about the socioeconomic conditions of a student that comes from and then have them try to achieve in school, that we have major problems because those children don't have the stability at home. And typically when you're talking about a child that doesn't have stability at home, it means the parents aren't working or they are living in conditions of fear or gang violence in their communities. They're not sure if their lights are going to be turned on. They're not sure where their next meal is going to come from. So these become distractions for an academic or an educational environment. The parents aren't as engaged in the process. Well, when we take that in totality and we think about that, and if you think out two or three steps, you'll realize that redevelopment agencies are specifically designed to deal with those communities of blight. Blight and depressed socioeconomic conditions go hand in hand. And what redevelopment agencies are designed to do are stabilize those communities, which ultimately stabilize people's home lives. They help create jobs. They help bring economic activity. When redevelopment is done correctly, you see crime go down. And these conditions that we are trying to impact have a much greater impact on a child's education than simply just moving more money into the schools, into these hands of administrators. This is the type of, you know, the redevelopment agency dollars can stabilize communities, and which, in my opinion, to be quite honest with you, impact education and public safety a whole lot more than just giving the dollars to those agencies. And I think that that's missed in this conversation, that the destruction that you would do to these communities would further, you know, suppress them than they already are, and not give them any opportunity for hope at moving into healthy, stable neighborhoods, which I think would impact our education system and our public safety even more.
Well, thank you very much, Councilmember Baines, and we appreciate you calling in today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks. Appreciate it.
I'd like to bring in Bill McEwen now from the Fresno Bee, columnist in the Bee, and read his columns about things like redevelopment. And I want to talk a little more about some of the politics behind this move. It's rather interesting, I think, that Governor Brown is proposing this elimination of redevelopment agencies. He was a big supporter of redevelopment during his tenure as mayor of Oakland back in the late 90s, early 2000s. How did this come about politically, and is this an attempt by eliminating the redevelopment agencies to do an end run around Prop 22 and finding a loophole in the law?
Well, you have to look at the history of redevelopment agencies, and I would want the listeners to understand that the creation of RDAs, what it did is it designated the elimination of blight in a very special and dedicated way, and therefore it actually elevated it above other services that cities provide. So it's got a special status, and it's separate from the general fund. In regard to Governor Brown, he ran as a budget crisis manager. And, you know, after his and his administration's analysis of where California is and the analysis of what the political realities are, I believe they felt that RDAs were an area they could go to get this money to close this budget gap. And RDAs are interesting in that when you talk about the politics of it, for example, the far right does not like RDAs in any way. And yet what you would call your garden variety Rockefeller Republican Chamber of Commerce type, they're very supportive of RDAs because they can result in profit for business. And then on the left, you have some people that don't like RDAs, but you also have people, as Council Member Baines just stated in the telephone call, that believe that RDAs can really improve a city. So you have a big mixture there. And I don't think this was an easy decision for Governor Brown. I think that what he saw was, hey, there's $2 billion there and I can go after it. And I actually will get support from the right, which he needs to get this budget deal done in the fashion that he wanted. So I think he was playing to some political interests on the right that would like to see RDAs eliminated.
Let's go to the phones now and take another call. We have Howard in Fresno. Howard, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you. The council members' comments, I think, point out the high benefit to the public to have RDAs. But a lot of the programs being proposed to be cut by the governor's budget to balance the state budget are good to have. And what I never hear from people that say, don't cut my budget, is what's the alternative? Where does the state, the governor, put together a budget that can get us back to a balanced state? And I'd like to hear somebody propose what's the alternative. Number two, is I'd like to see the city councils pass resolutions urging the Republican representatives to support the special election. If they think cutting the RDA is bad, wait to see what happens if we don't have a special election and do not get some of the current taxes extended. And I think it's utter hypocrisy for local governments that are clamoring, don't cut our budgets, but not calling for the special election and calling for all representatives in Sacramento to support the special election.
Well, Howard, thank you very much for that call, and I'll direct that to Council Member Westerlund. How do you respond to that?
Well, let me tell you what the Big Ten mayors proposed, and we did make a proposal to the governor, which fell on deaf ears. It didn't go anywhere. One of the things that the governor had told the Big Ten mayors, and I know Mayor Swearingen was working on this, was I need $1.7 billion. And we went back to the things and looked at it and said one of the proposals came forward is, you know, what we'll do is we'll find a way to legally get around Proposition 22, and I'm not sure we ever figured out exactly how to do that legally, but either voluntarily, and we will pass through tax increment to the state in the amount of about $200 million. That $200 million then would have allowed the state on a several-year basis to be able to go out and bond for $1.7 billion, which is what the governor said he needed to cover this tax year and cover this budget year. And then it had a portion above what was required to bond for the $1.7 billion, an additional $50 million or so that would have gone into the general fund. Anyway, when that proposal went forward, it just fell on deaf ears. As a matter of fact, the administration said, well, it sounded like a Wall Street financing scheme. So when we've proposed ideas and we've proposed reforms that went along with that, they have gone nowhere. And that's one of the tough things about this is, you know, we end up kind of negotiating with ourselves because we have not gotten a response from the governor on this.
Now, Bill, to turn to you, and many of the critics of redevelopment in the state bring up a number of things. Sacramento, for example, the city of Sacramento's redevelopment agency spent millions of dollars to help subsidize a just-opened mermaid bar, literally a mermaid bar on the K Street Mall in Sacramento. People cite things like that as examples of waste. They cite...
Well, RDA money to spruce up an already luxurious golf course in Southern California is a great example. RDAs are fairly easy targets, and one of the reasons is there hasn't been a lot of transparency with some of them. And part of the fault is the media. You know, it's another agency to cover. And so what they do tends not to get a bright light on them. The other thing is no real standard definition of blight. And RDAs around the state play games with that to expand their RDA areas. And so what I'm thinking is it's not clear if Governor Brown will be able to pull this off. I think it's definitely headed to the courts. But we are going to have some kind of RDA, whether they're called RDAs or not, in the future. And the people that are the leaders in this, that it would really behoove them to voluntarily adopt reform measures and clean up their act. I think one thing that happens is RDA become too big, and in the city of Fresno, and Council Member Westerlund can correct me if I'm wrong, because at one time nearly half of the city was an RDA area, and we've grown a little bit more to the north, so maybe it's not fully half anymore. But my point would be if you're not doing a lot of projects and generating that tax increment, I just see it as an erosion of the general fund. And the other thing that happens is while these RDA projects are put out to bid in some cities, the RDA is cozy with the developer, and the developer pitches an idea behind the scenes, and then the next thing you know, RDA, an area is being declared blighted, so it's basically being set up for that developer. So there aren't really enough safeguards in the system, and I think the biggest failure is just not enough sunlight on what's going on there.
Now, Councilmember Westerlund, the issue with redevelopment is one of the issues is I think it's a little hard to understand from the public's perspective. What are some of the projects that RDA is helping to fund in Fresno now that our listeners might be familiar with but not necessarily know that their tax dollars are helping to build these things?
Great question. And if I can key off of Bill just for a second, and at least when I look at the RDA map in the city, it's more like a quarter to a third is in the redevelopment area, but almost everything into the south is, and certainly to the southwest and southeast of Fresno, is in redevelopment project areas. And you might have remembered, not too long ago, we had Mr. Trump who was hanging around here, and they wanted to do a redevelopment project area out by Broken Horse, Running Horse. And anyway, I got in a lot of trouble with the former mayor on that by going to him and saying, it'll never be a blighted area because you can't make Thompson seedless grapes a blighted area.
Well, it specifically says that ag right. area cannot be blighted.
Right. So there are some criteria, but it certainly needs to be tightened up. And I think there are ways to be able to do that. But let me tell you, absolutely all of the downtown housing development that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years, every single one of those has redevelopment gap financing. There's a shortage there, and the affordable housing allows us to invest in those. And so that's where we've seen a beginning and really some traction begin in housing in downtown Fresno. But let me give you a anecdotal evidence, and this is really kind of where our bread and butter is for the redevelopment agency. We had an employer come to us, and they were going to consolidate some of their manufacturing into Fresno. They had about 30 employees, and they were going to go ahead and move some more manufacturing here, but they needed the streets, gutters, curbs, and sidewalks in front of their place fixed up because they were going to bring in people who are engineers, people who, really can go places elsewhere for work if they wanted to. So we invested about $1.5 million. They moved, and part of the agreement was, we'll invest this money. You put in 100 new jobs and agree to keep that lease for 10 years. They signed off on that, said no problem. They brought in the 100 additional jobs plus the 30 they already had there. And then they've now added another 180 jobs to it for a total of about 286 jobs.
We're just about out of time. Before we go, I want to ask Bill one last question. We're looking at $1.7 billion in RDA funds that were unspent. In terms of a $25 billion budget gap, that's not a whole lot. Already RDAs have spent in this interim period between the time the governor announced this issue and today, they've spent a lot of that money. Is this setting us up for another one-year budget fix and one that is not necessarily a big
Well, Dan debt? Walters of the Sacramento Bee, I think he's really the only journalist in the state who's been hot on this in the past week and pointing out that even though the legislative analyst's office said Governor Brown's budget fix had promise and that if you looked out, let's say, 4 or 5 years, California would be on even keel, the evidence now is more and more that even a five-year tax extension is not going to cure the budget problem.
Well, that's just about all for our program today. I'd like to thank Councilmember Larry Westerlin and Chair of the RDA for joining us today. And in Fresno, we'd also like to thank Daniel Ainsley, the City of Merced's Development Manager, for joining us on our program today. And Bill McEwen, thank you for stopping by.
Sure thing.
Thank you.
That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, and production manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.